And hello to Dr. Radio Reports. I'm Dr. Michael Perskin. I usually do the Healthy Aging Show, but today we're doing Dr. Radio Reports, and we'll just jump right into it. In 2015, there were an estimated 47.8 million people over the age of 65 in the United States. That number is growing, and by 2060, it's estimated that number will more than double to over 98 million people. Now, the lifestyles that those of age 65 and up are leading is also changing. Education levels are rising, older adults are working longer, and the population is more racially and ethnically diverse. But while most people say that they want to live a long, happy life and plan for finances or their care needs, few think about how to plan for an end-of-life journey with meaning and happiness. So today, we're going to talk about that sort of plan and about what it takes to make that plan and follow it through with two guests. I'm very pleased to have John Leland. He's a Metro reporter for the New York Times and author of the New York Times bestselling book, Happiness is a Choice You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old, published in January of this year. His two previous books, Hip, The History, A Cultural History of Hipness, and Why Kerouac Matters, The Lessons of On the Road, They're Not What You Think, published in 2007. Also, Dr. Mark Gronin joins us, an adult and geriatric psychiatrist, a director of mental health services, and the founding director of the Memory Center and Alzheimer's Clinical Research Programs at Miami Jewish Health in Florida. Author of several books, including How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old in 2011, and its sequel, The End of Old Age, Living a Longer, More Purposeful Life, 2018, published. All good books. John, Mark, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Really happy to be here.
Sure. And Mark, just so you know, I'm a geriatrician by training and practice here at NYU Langone Medical Center for our listeners. And, you know, I love this topic, and I love the work that you guys have both done in this area in your books and John's articles in the Times, which I've read with interest over the past year, and I enjoyed the book, Mark. Because I do this every day. I talk to older people about their lives, and it's the reason why I went into this. I'll tell you guys a short story about that in a minute, but maybe we can start with you, Dr. Gronin. Maybe just, what is happiness? What's contentment? What is it? Right? People seem to always be searching. And in New York, where I live, they're often not happy. People are not happy.
I think that's a great question to start off with when we're talking about aging, because it really sets the scene that aging has to be viewed in a more positive way. All of us are doing it, we're doing it longer, and we should be talking about happiness and contentment. You know, I cast it in terms of the term wellness, and I like to describe this as you age, having a sense of meaning, a sense of direction, satisfaction with your circumstances. Sometimes it involves happiness per se, but not always. I think it's much deeper than that. And it's having a sense of worth for yourself, for your aging self. We really need to change the landscape here. And I'm certain that you're seeing this in your practice. I know that this is what John saw in the time he spent with older individuals. It gives us a sense how aging is evolving over time, but also really what are some of the richness that's part of it. And this has to be entered into this equation. We need to stop just looking at aging from a negative perspective.
Okay, well, I think that's great. So people, optimism, you may know, is associated with longevity in general. So now, John, tell us about the book, Happiness is a Choice You Make. And what's the concept?
It grew out of a 2015 series I did in which I followed six people over the age of 85 for a year. And these were long conversations that I would have with them and over a long period of time. And they were very different from the conversations that a lot of times we have with older people, whether they're patients or our family members, where we're trying to fix people's problems. I didn't have to fix anybody's problems. All I was doing was just talking to them about their lives. And at the end of a year, I had these wonderful relationships with the people, and I couldn't give it up. So I needed to do something else just to keep the relationships going. So I thought about the ways that I had been changed over the course of the year just from the time I spent with them. And I really did that the book is partly it's about getting old, but it's about the lessons that I learned from them that are valid for anybody, people of any age.
And John, these people are all over 85.
That's right. They were 87 to 92 at the start. So they're 3 years older now.
So that's what we call the oldest old, right? We call them, you know, in geriatrics, 65 to 75 is young old, 75 to 84 is just old, and over 85, 85 and above is sort of old old. That's what we call it. And then some people like to call people above 100 super centenarians.
And we didn't used to have these people. When I was born, there were fewer than a million people 85 and up, and now there's almost 6 million. So it's like, imagine if there were suddenly six times as many teenagers running around.
That would
and
scary.
Even the term old, old is becoming antiquated because it's becoming so common to see people 100 and above that we even have to change the terminology that we use.
Yeah, I think so. Mark, you could talk a little bit how, you know, the concept. So now you're growing older, and I'll give you guys a little demographic nugget that as I prepared for today's show, I thought about. So, and you guys can tell me what you think. So I learned a dozen years ago from a really smart young guy that human beings need only three things. They need someone to love, something to do, and something to hope for. And that was very instructive for me in my medical practice because I kind of, instead of, sometimes I like to think about the person, and if they have those three things, they're pretty good. And the something to do for many people for much of their life is work. And then somehow someone invented retirement, which I never really understood, right? Because historically people worked until they got sick, right? If they could. And I don't want to digress too much and take the stage away from you guys or the microphone. But talk, Mark, a little bit about how the concept and execution has changed as our lifespans have changed.
Sure. I think increasingly we're seeing that retirement is not the beginning of the end for people, but it's just another life transition, a time for planning new and different things. And that really speaks to the central point that I write about in The End of Old Age, is that we need to look at all the strengths that we gain because of aging. You know, you talked about three things that people need, and I would add to that things that people gain as they get older. And I focus on three things: wisdom, purpose, and creativity.
Yeah.
These are really fundamental life forces. They shape who we are and what we do. And as opposed to so many other things that we measure in terms of our body or brain function that seem to change and at times decline, wisdom, purpose, and creativity, along with other factors, get better, grow, develop, enhance because of aging, not in spite of it. And so the idea of retirement being, a time to kind of slide into home base, in the face of that, it sounds ridiculous because the average person is going to have not a few years, but decades with so much time and so many opportunities ahead of them. And if they're able to look at this in terms of the positive aspects of it, they're able to focus on a sense of purpose, it really transforms what that time can be. It doesn't wish away the challenges that we all face. There's no question about that. But it helps us be more resilient. It helps us get through them and to really do new and different things. And I think those are the lessons that we see. And I know, John certainly saw those in the time he spent with people. We begin to see the incredible gifts of aging.
Yeah, and let's focus a little bit on the purpose, because that's sort of a little bit about work. But work doesn't have to be a job where you make money. Work could be something to do. And I would tell you, that's where I see people who have difficulties, who need help. They don't have a sense of purpose at some point. And they're not necessarily upset about it sometimes, but to me, as an observer and a professional, I worry about that. And some people are very articulate. One guy told me recently, he's young, right, so he's only like 78, that he used to run a not-for-profit home for disabled people. And, he was the executive director. He had about 100 people or so working for him. And what he misses most is that. He's not needed. Yeah. And so, John, I'm going to switch back to you and to talk about the folks that you write about, the six people What were some of the subjects you spoke about?
Well, I want to touch on what you just said for a second. My mother is one of those people who lost her purpose in life. Mm-hmm. She says that the first quarter of her life, she was growing up and getting her education. The next half of it, she was working and raising a family. And then for the last quarter of it, she's 89 now, she doesn't have a role in life. And she called herself a useless eater, which is, I think, term with a horrible history to it. And so I understand that. But I think it's especially people that, with some people, like they don't have a sense of purpose if they don't have their career anymore. They're not, when my last name is no longer of the New York Times, I like to think I'll still be happy. But other people are all different. I set out to get a wide variety of people. They're gay and straight and black and white and Asian and poor and relatively well-to-do. Nobody was super rich, and they lived in from nursing homes to private apartments, and the things that they had in common were a sense of resilience. They'd all known loss, and none of them defined themselves by their loss. So we know people that get knocked off their bearings for a second, and they don't recover.
Yeah.
But all these people had a lot of experience getting knocked off their bearings and recovering from it. So they didn't let little transitory setbacks really floor them. They all had a sense of gratitude and, to a greater and lesser extent, that sense of purpose that Dr. Agronin talks about. And I buried the lead here, which is that Dr. Agronin's book is just marvelous. And I'm so pleased to be on this with you.
Okay.
My thoughts are equal as well. It's really, it's wonderful not only to be on the program with John, but to know that, this whole topic of this new approaches to aging are being talked about and promoted is so important.
Yeah, well, I think it's time because, the baby boomer generation is one of those generations that demands attention. So this is the way that it's happening, right? And I'm in the sort of the youngest part of the baby boom generations, but I'm well away from retirement. And so I'm watching with interest. But obviously, I chose this field of geriatrics. But circling back to the content area, so let me come back to you, Mark, about the resilience piece. And I'm going to tie it back to this, so what I call, what to expect when you get older, which you both have written about to some degree, but people don't seem to think about, which has been fascinated me since I went into practice. And what I'll have is, and I just had an example of this yesterday in the office. I hadn't seen this couple in about 3 years. The gentleman, they don't have particular stress in terms of finance. I think he was quite successful. They have no children. They have each other, which is lovely. And they've been together for many years. He's about 87 and she's about 74, 75. She's pretty healthy. He is okay, but really needs a new knee that he doesn't want. So he's really starting to fail. And I couldn't even begin to engage her because I've only seen her once 3 years ago. She doesn't go to doctors. And the fact that she probably ought to expect that something's going to happen to her 87-year-old husband who's almost, or actually is homebound without her. So Mark, with that preface, what are your thoughts about that? Because I think she's not alone in that, this particular pitch.
Sure. This is some very common, scenarios that we see in practice with older individuals. To me, aging is something that you don't do alone. You don't want to do alone. There's strength in numbers, strength in community. A lot of adult children struggle with aging parents. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to cope with it. And that's part of the reason I wrote this book, because I want to emphasize the fact that you have to look at the strengths that are still there and developing at the same time you're considering some of the difficulties. And I think that helps people in terms of their involvement with loved ones and others. I can tell you it certainly helps me as a physician working with situations that seem very difficult and very desperate. When you can extract and discover what those strengths are, what those abilities are, and build upon them and give people help. Not only does it reassure everyone, but then it's not just a single person aging and facing difficulties. It's a group effort, and that makes all the difference. And I really encourage younger people and older people to interact. Someone like that, you could look at as facing a huge loss coming up. And indeed, you know, that's inevitable in all our lives. But if we can loop in family and other resources and ourselves as physicians and stop thinking of ourselves as just someone who, you know, walks in, gives a pill and walks out, but as someone forming a relationship with them, it can really be transformative all around. But it has to start with changing the way we look at aging. If we look at aging as just a slide to the end and only from a perspective of decline, sometimes we never even get to the point where we take those extra efforts or we adopt the type of attitude that's going to be most helpful for people and for ourselves.
Okay, I think that's well said. And I love the fact that you focus on the optimistic and the positives, right? Because that's really the only way to get people off the negatives. Now, John, I'll come back to you with this question. So of the folks you interviewed, what can you give me an example of some resilience that really impressed you or surprised you or was the most indelible?
Yeah, there's a man named Fred Jones who was 87 when I met him. He was living alone in a walk-up apartment. He was in the process of losing parts of two toes to an infection that was turning into gangrene. I would see Fred and I would say, Fred, what's your favorite part of the day? And Fred would just smile and say, waking up in the morning and saying, thank God for another day, on my way to 110. And this gratitude that Fred had that he had developed, I don't know quite how, you know, really got him through these days. And it meant that he wasn't just, you know, grateful to me for visiting or grateful to somebody who does something. Gratitude was the way he looked at the world all the time. And it was meant like seeing the world as a benign place. So Fred spent a lot of time alone, but he didn't get lonely, I think, for that reason, that he felt connected to the world. He wasn't, the world wasn't his enemy that he needed to beat out. So I think that was really important. So that's something, he was always in a better mood than I was.
Yeah, it's hard to teach that and have a sense of that. But I've noticed that kind of thing in some patients that, you know, they have this built-in view that every day is a gift.
Yeah, and Fred would say,
I was just going to say, in some ways, our brains develop to be better at doing that. You know, we research shows we tend to be more positive and focus on more positive experiences as we get older. Our brains are less impulsive or less emotionally reactive. And so I think, you know, I love what John is describing. But we shouldn't think of that as an anomaly, as something that we can't attain.
Yeah.
We should realize that our brains are developing in ways that are better able to have those perspectives.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, let's invite our listeners to call in. If you have a question, this is Dr. Michael Perskin on Dr. Radio Reports. I'm typically the host of the Healthy Aging Show, Mondays 4 to 6 Eastern here on Sirius XM 110, where we broadcast from Dr. Radio. And we're going to take your calls or emails if you have questions about this topic, which is maybe you have a story about resilience in an older person or someone who was very wise, or yourself, if you're listening. We'd love to hear from you as I chat with Dr. Mark Agronin and Dr. John Leland, both authors on books on basically positive perspectives of getting older. And you can call us at 877-NYU-DOCS. That's 877-698-3627. Or send an email, docs@SiriusXM.com. And we do have an email from Tina, who writes, I'm listening to your show, and I'm wondering if there's a way I can help my father-in-law, who is suffering from depression and isolation after retiring. He loved his work, but the company decided it was time for him to go and convinced him to retire. He seems rudderless now and rarely can even be convinced to leave the house. Is there a way to reintroduce an elderly person to happiness, even if unwillingly? I think we should go with Mark to answer that as the psychiatrist of the group.
Well, I would start with determining, is he really suffering from a clinical depression, or what we call major depressive disorder? Because if that's the case, the good news is that we have really effective treatments for that, and that could be a game changer for him. You know, not everyone in his circumstances is necessarily depressed or suffering from depression. There could be other factors, and you know, as a geriatrician, you know very well that there can be memory issues, there can be anxiety disorders, there can be physical issues going on, and until you identify and treat those, it's hard to move forward with other things. So that has to really be the first step. And I would also encourage you know, her to sit and talk with him and try to get a sense for, you know, what is he experiencing? You know, how is he defining his situation? And, you know, what is he willing to do or consider? Because that dialogue can be helpful. And also, at a certain point, sitting down and talking about what are his assets, what are his strengths. And I give the analogy in an action plan in my book of, you know, when you sit down with a financial planner and review all your assets and your insurance and you plan for the future, to some extent, we should also do that for our personal assets. What are our interests, our abilities? What do we want to do? And sometimes the experience of doing that, especially with someone that we really care about, can be wonderful and can give us a better sense and a more hopeful sense for what we can do.
Okay, absolutely. And hopefully Tina's father-in-law can improve a little bit. So Tina, thank you for writing. Now, John, maybe, you know, I often find when people lose their job, that's a sense of loss, right? It's like they're grieving. And so, you know, I might view Tina's in-law, father-in-law, as kind of having a complicated grief reaction to the loss of his job. But how did your folks who were optimistic that you talked to handle losses? Because they must have had losses.
They all had losses. And they, as I said, they were pretty good at dealing with loss because they lost everything. You know, the women had all lost husbands. Yeah. One of the men had lost his partner of 60 years. And they dealt with, I think, when they dealt with it successfully or when they dealt with it positively, they dealt with it by concentrating on all the things they could still do. One of the guys wanted to play piano when he got older. He couldn't. He had gout. His hands, his fingers right. wouldn't do that anymore. So he made do with putting his energies into the things that he loved. So he would listen to music and really focus on it. And he knew that he wouldn't have a long time to hear his favorite operas. So, you know, he didn't do the dishes while he was listening. He would focus in on that. He wouldn't have a lot of opportunities to have his friends visit. So whenever they came, you know, he focused like a laser on them. I think that one thing we do with people like Tina's father is we focus on fixing their problems rather than finding out what are the things that have given them joy throughout life. Her father was, I think, in the early 80s, right?
Yeah.
So he's had...
Oh, she didn't give an age, actually.
You know, he's had years of finding joy in his life. And those things that gave him joy... One of them was his job, and that's gone. But maybe there's elements of his job that he can take into other parts of his life. And there's other things that he did that would have given him joy. So, you know, it's interesting. Doctors and professionals are always trying to fix people's problems. Kids are always trying to fix mom's problems, dad's problems. And we often forget to ask about the richness in their lives.
Yeah, I think that's really very true. And one of the things I love about my job is hearing about what people have accomplished or plan to accomplish at older ages.
Yeah, no, but you'll never be compensated for coming up. Patient likes ice cream. You know,
no, not really.
And yet, that might be very important to that patient.
It could be important, and it depends on how you characterize it. So that's documenting the patient's preferences.
Now, patient likes sex and ice cream, yes.
Yeah, that's an easy one. They go, you know, they can even go together. So, Mark, maybe also talk a little bit from a psychiatric perspective on this loss. So, and I'm going to tie it back to this depression. So a lot of times as a doctor, when I'm doing a depression screen or talking to people or many common scenarios, one of the children tells me, you have to start my mother on an antidepressant. She's very depressed. And when you talk to them and you really think about the questions that a physician asks a patient about that. So there's two issues. One, it's really their mood. They're in a bad mood. And two, and this is the thing I'd like you to focus on for me, Mark, is, you know, they often say something akin to, well, why shouldn't I be depressed? All my friends died. You know, I don't know any of my neighbors anymore. My husband passed away 6 years ago. Why shouldn't I be depressed? And Mark, what do you think about that?
Sure. Well, first I want to say I think John should be teaching medical students about talking with people in interview because I think he makes such an important point. And I love the point about ice cream because really what he's talking about, which is it should be the central role of a physician, is you're forming a relationship with someone, you know, a bond with them.
Yeah.
And all the information should flow from that. I think today, often doctors are too robotic at times. You know, we have our script, we have the questions we need to ask. And it's true, we become so task-focused that we lose sight of what we're trying to do. And a big part of that is, you know, forming a relationship with someone. So questions like, what are your joys, what's important to you, flow as easily and as commonly as questions about, you know, what's going on with your blood pressure, how are you sleeping, how are you eating? Because, you raise this issue when someone says, you know, I faced all these losses, what do I do, what do I cope? And I hear and see that all the time, and frankly, sometimes I don't have an answer. And my role is to be there with them and to offer whatever knowledge I have medically or scientifically. But at the end of the day, finding meaning and purpose in their lives is something that it has to be, you know, something that I can't do for them, that they have to do. But it also stems from having connections with others and having a sense of hope. And think about how powerful it is, whether you're a doctor or a friend or a reporter, whatever, to shine that light on someone and to give them that attention and that time and to really demonstrate that you value them and you want to learn from them. And I will come back to the central point I make in The End of Old Age, and that I say over and over again, that if you don't have a positive take on aging, if you're not willing to look for the benefit and elements that the strengths that we gain, it's hard to get to that point, because then you don't even have a motivation to do that. And I think one thing that both John and myself really emphasize in our writing is that, you know, that listening, that regard, that valuing is so important, and that in and of itself is transformative.
Yeah, I agree. And just so you know, Mark, so I typically ask patients, if I haven't seen them in a while, or if I'm worried about them, or if they're a new patient, how they spend their days. That's the right, because that's sort of what I want to know.
And
they just then tell me how they spend their day.
It's a wonderful question, and I would argue that scientifically questions like that make a difference. And I recently wrote about how, you know, doctors should ask about what someone's sense of purpose is. Because if you look at studies, they've shown that having a sense of purpose is as powerful in terms of wellness and longevity as exercise and diet and whatnot. And yet we really don't focus on that, and we don't realize how important that is to our sense of wellness and being and even our physical sense.
Okay, fair enough. Well, we do have a caller. We're going to speak to Cheryl, who's calling from California. Hey, Cheryl, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Okay. Do you have a question for us or a story to share, Cheryl?
Yeah, I do have a question. I have aging parents. My father's 84. My mom is 82. We are watching my mother slowly decline. She has mild to moderate arthritis, but she has developed a memory problem. My dad is in great shape. He has become her full-time caretaker, and we're kind of watching this take a toll on him. My mom should have had a knee replacement many years ago. She refuses to do so. The memory problem she has is more places and things. She will say, you know, we went to that museum. What's the name of that place? And who was that person with us? You know, he had on the green shirt. She remembers the surrounding details, but she won't remember other aspects. She's in denial about having a memory problem. She spends about 90% of her time in bed, so my dad waits on her pretty much hand and foot. It's taking a toll on the entire family, and as I said, she deals with it with anger and denial, so we don't really address it. A neurologist referred her to a neuropsych for neuropsych testing. She walked out saying, I'm not doing this childish testing. And then we watch her cognitively continue to decline, and my dad becomes more and more burdened with her care. So as adult children, we just really don't know what to do. And my dad says, I need help. I don't want to talk to her about it because I have to live with her and she gets mad. So we're just wondering, where should we go? You know, seeing her stay in bed, my dad taking care of her, and her memory and cognition continuing to get worse and worse.
And how old do you say your mom is?
My mom is 82 years old.
And what part of California do they live in?
We're in Southern California, an area called the Inland Empire.
Okay, so, you know, I'd start with talking to her primary doctor, who may send her to a geriatric psychiatrist if he can get her to go. But why don't you tell us a little bit about your mom before she got sick, right? Then sort of aligns with the points we spoke about. What was she like before this happened?
She was relatively sedentary. She has always been very vain, very social. And even with her grooming right now, she's just not really...
Yeah, but Cheryl, but just think back. So she's 84 now. So 10 years ago, what was she doing with herself? How'd she spend her day?
She was involved with her family. She was involved with her family. We're a small, close family. She was involved with her friends, but... still home, you know, home a lot, except for holidays and special occasions. You know, lots of concerts, lots of plays, that sort of thing. She was out and about a lot more 10 years ago. Now she is getting to a point where if I make a plan for a play, she may cancel. She doesn't seem really interested in getting out of the house very often.
All right. Let's ask Dr. Groner if he has any comments or suggestions.
Sure. Well, this is not uncommon. The bed can become a magnet for some people. You know, one question just with my psychiatrist hat on for a moment is, you know, if she's had some cognitive changes, maybe she has a form of what we call neurocognitive disorder, you know, one of the most common manifestations is apathy. So literally the brain's ability to motivate itself is not there. And so, you know, that may be one reason. It might not be willful that she wants to stay in bed. It might be that her brain's just not motivating itself. And so, you know, suggestion of if there's a way to get a geriatric psychiatrist to weigh in could be really important, because there are medications and treatments that can help with that. But in addition, and I would hearken back to what we spoke about before, you know, you want to sit with the family and think about what does she enjoy, what can she do if for whatever reason she's not going to leave that bed, what can you bring to her, whether it's music, whether it's art, whether it's family discussions, movies, at least that if she's in a room in her bed, you can create a whole world and there are things that give her joy and meaning, and maybe that will spark some more motivation or some more confidence or whatever to get her mobilized out of it. It's a tough situation, and there's no other way to put it, but there probably are lots of points of leverage that are still undiscovered yet and haven't been activated that might help the situation.
All right. Well, Cheryl, thanks for your call. And Mark, do you – I would imagine – sorry, John, that the folks you interviewed didn't really go through periods like this.
Oh, they had. One of the women Ping Wang, this woman, Chinese woman, her son had been murdered in a department store in China. I'm sorry, in China. And so she spent a couple of years just completely depressed. She couldn't sleep. And she, through her the companionship of the people around her, she was able to get over that loss. But it was very, very difficult for her. I think one thing that makes things very difficult, and it may be the case with her mother, is there's this idea that if you're older and you're depressed, you're failing at something. You know, and I think we have this idea, be all you can be. We should all be like that older person that jumps out of airplanes and drinks martinis and runs the marathon. And one of the things I like about Mark's book, and this is true of my book as well, we don't shy away from the hardships of this period of time, and people do end up like that. And you can't tell them that they're failing at old age, and, you know, we have this phrase, successful aging, makes you think, like, oh, yeah, if you just, you know, keep playing tennis, you can keep playing tennis. Well, you might not be able to.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's true. Well, that loss of control is depressing to people, because if people acquire enough chronic conditions, they become disabled. It sounds like Cheryl's mom is clearly disabled. Now, if she weren't before, just from being in bed, she's deconditioned enough in terms of her muscle strength that now she is disabled at 84.
And I think what John said is so perfect, because when I set out to write the book, I said, this is going to include everybody. I'm not only going to focus on, you know, the well and active people. I use the term the ninth stage. It's a term that Eric Erickson and Joan Erickson had coined for the very, very last stage of life, where people can be quite debilitated. But I emphasize that, you know, these issues can still apply at that point, because even if you're physically declining or you have cognitive impairment, it doesn't mean that you still can't have meaningful, joyful experiences. It will be different from before. It may be more limited in many respects. All the more obligation and opportunity and honor that all of us have, and younger people have, to be involved with someone, to help them, to bring that to them. And when you do that, sometimes you'll see amazing, amazing things. Things will emerge from people that you didn't even believe could be there.
And you know, Mark talked about purpose. You know, joy may not be available to somebody with
sure.
depressive problems.
That's true.
But purpose can still be available to people who suffer from depression.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. All right, we got another caller. We've got Keith on the line from Florida. Keith, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I lost my job. I'm 79 years old, and so what you were discussing kind of hit home to me. But what I started doing was volunteering at different areas. I found out that the local sheriff's department lacked volunteers, so I did that, and now they are teaching me different things that has to do with the sheriff's department. I joined the Civil Air Patrol. They're showing me how to fly a plane. I'm not going to be able to get a license or anything, but at least it's interesting. They're teaching me radio, teaching me video, taking pictures out of planes for hurricane damage. And I volunteer at the hospital as well, running the carts around, so I get to visit with new people. And all of these places that you volunteer, you meet new people. And doing things. Sometimes there's payment in terms of they feed you lunch or dinner or something. But anyway, you get to do something and meet new people.
Well, Keith, that's great advice, and you're an excellent example of what both of my guests are talking about. John, any response? Any comments?
Well, what's he doing? He's growing because he's learning new things. He's got purpose because he sets out to do. He has companionship. He sees people all the time. And one thing I would say is there's a kind of interdependence where he's doing things for people and letting people do things for him. And I think a lot of people, they struggle when they have to give up some of their independence.
Yeah.
They can't do everything for themselves anymore. But if you can also find ways to be helpful to those people that are helping you, it makes it a two-way relationship, and I think it's a much stronger relationship. We love independence. It's a huge value of American spirit,
yeah.
But interdependence is such a stronger thing.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right on that count. Additional thoughts, Mark?
I agree completely, and I think John said it so well.
All right. Hey, so Mark, who did you write this book for? What age group?
I think anyone from middle age and above, and I suppose even younger people, you know, who want to know more about aging and to see aging as a dynamic force, I think it's open for. And I've gotten feedback across the lifespan. I would tell you that what I love the most is when individuals in their 80s and 90s who've read it come in and talk to me, and they want to share with me their own experiences and their wisdom. That's the best thing about it. And the action plan at the end was based on sitting down with a group of individuals in their 80s and 90s and going through parts of the book and trying things out. And as I stayed in the book, I was blown away by the time spent with them. I thought I would be there as a doctor to try to teach them things, and they taught me. It was just extraordinary. And So to me, it's open for everyone. The title, The End of Old Age, is really to say we need to end this notion, this negative notion of being old, and look at aging as a positive dynamic force. And so I think that applies well across a good part of the lifespan.
Okay, I think that is well said. But what about if you're an introvert? What if you're someone who that's not something that comes easy to you, and most people's personalities get more so as they age. So if you're an extrovert, like our Keith, and Keith, thank you for calling. Right, our caller was obviously an extrovert, right? He loves to meet new people and makes relationships easily, to your point, John. So he seems like a natural at developing interdependent relationships. Yes?
Yeah.
And so he's good at it. But some people aren't so good at it. So Mark, what should they do?
Well, I'll give you an example. A woman that I interviewed for the book was someone who was retiring from teaching. Her whole life was planned out in terms of what she would do after she ended her teaching career. And within a very short period of time, her partner passed away. She lost her mother, her aunt. I mean, the main individuals in her life disappeared. And she was not someone we call extrovert. These were her main relationships in life. And
right.
So just like the caller, who described things doing, she found things that were meaningful for her. In this case, she did, I think, the opposite of what many people would want to do. She felt that she wasn't able to fulfill all the caregiving in her experiences with these losses. And so she actually joined a program that teaches volunteers to work with hospice patients, and got involved one-on-one with individuals who were quite ill. What she brought to them, the kindness, the wisdom, just the companionship, was extraordinary. And it gave her meaning and actually helped her deal with these losses. But I think that's a good example of someone who may be more introverted. But there are so many different opportunities out there for people to be involved in so many different potential relationships that it's not a barrier in any way.
All right, and so I'm gonna circle back, Mark, to what you said about, and I know it's in the book, about constructing a plan for this kind of fourth quarter of life, as some have called it. But I'm gonna ask Mark this. So you talked to these older people, and you were impressed that they could be content and had wonderful lives and still have a lot to look forward to. But did that change you in what you do today and what you're planning for in your life? And if it did, how so?
Well, this is part of the reason I love to spend time with people, because I feel like I'm mapping out what I will do myself in that time with them and learning from their wisdom. I'll tell you what it taught me, and I already found this to apply in my own personal relationships. And for instance, my mom and I had a whole talk about this recently. Is that some things don't just fall into your lap. They just don't happen automatically. If you're struggling with a time in life when you're feeling lonely or you're feeling bereft or you're going through losses, you have to take some action. You have to put some energy into reaching out to people or being open to others reaching out to you. And I wanted to write an action plan, which is just very simple. And it's really about sitting down and beginning by just taking stock of who you are, what you've done, your experiences, your abilities, your interests. It's simple, but it's very powerful. It's something that sometimes we don't, it's so obvious that we don't do it. And I think that's what I've learned from others who have found ways to deal with losses and who are resilient and gain this wisdom. That they focus on what they have and they take stock of it and they feel a sense of hope in what they can do. That can make all the difference, and that's a true lesson that I learn every day from patients.
And John, I would ask the same question of you, because you spoke to all these people and were impressed by their stories and acquired their narratives. So what effect did it have on you?
I've been completely changed around by this. My friends will tell you, like, I'm kind of annoying because I'm too upbeat a person now. But, I was a grouchy, I'm a newspaper reporter, and I'm trained to, like, look at problems and see things that need to be fixed. And I think I've become much more optimistic, much more grateful, patient, and less covetous or vengeful. You can see these people, like, nope, in a year, none of them talked about the accomplishments they'd had in their jobs. So you say, okay, well, that doesn't matter that much. None of them said, you know, I used to have the, well, actually one said he used to have the best suits because he was like a player.
Yeah.
But no one then said, like, I used to have the fanciest house on the block.
Yeah.
So, like, you, some of that fades away. Some of them were fairly isolated, and I think the one risk there is too much dependence on one person, if all your social relations are with one person.
Yes.
But I think, like, curating and having a small circle of people can be very helpful. And, you know, none of them wanted to go to cocktail parties and meet strangers. No one, none of them wanted to go on blind dates. That kind of thing was over. But they were interested in things that were kind of pleasing in the moment. And I've learned to take satisfaction from that.
So it sounds like you had an attitude adjustment by this.
Yes.
Right. So, but did you change any behaviors because of it?
It changed my relationship with my mother. I deal with her much better now. As I said, we tend to try to fix people's problems. And what I realized was that I was learning so much talking to these other people. And when I saw my mother, all I thought about was what I could do for her. So
yes.
it became much more give and take. And now when we sit down together, I'm learning from her as she's getting something from me. So that's a positive thing. I don't know. I think I'm just more loving to the people around me. That I didn't change my saving for my retirement or anything like that. And I didn't quit my job and go, you know, live in a yurt someplace. So I still do the same things I do. But, you know, that attitude adjustment is not a little thing. It's a big thing.
Yeah, and I think some of that is, of course, we're all getting older. And then, you know, the question is, do you get older, like, gradually, or do you sort of have step functions where you sort of something happens? You know, I'll answer the question of myself since I gave you guys the opportunities. Is what I've noticed is much more acceptance of what I can't control as I'm in the middle of midlife now. Sometimes some things you can't control. The weather, obviously, is the classic one. And not getting annoyed with the sort of the nonsense of living in New York, which can be brutal on a granular minute-by-minute level, if you let it get to you. Or you could just shrug your shoulders and move on. You know, to give you a concrete example of those two things. So turns out I'm very particular in how much half and half I put in whatever coffee I'm drinking. And so what it took me a while to figure out, for a couple of years, I would practice different ways of asking people behind the counter how much half and half to put in because I grew up in a world where if you said, you know, I have a regular coffee, that meant two sugars and some milk. And everyone seemed to know that. It was like a convention here in New York, and that's gone. So I was trying to adjust to this, and it was kind of fascinating to me, and I couldn't do it. So in the end, what I decided was I can only really get coffee where I can pour my own milk or half and half into it. I just won't go to a place where they don't let me do that because I won't be happy with the result. So I've accepted that and changed my behavior because of it. And I'm happier for it.
Well, we give up feeling screwed if something doesn't work out the way we want it, right?
Yeah.
Because life doesn't work out the way you want it all the time.
Pretty much. All right.
You know, what I love about these stories is, you know, we all want to, we think we want to look and feel and be young or be like having younger brains. But what we're all saying is that the older brains have a lot to teach us and older individuals. And we learn from that. And that's such a critically important point.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna ask anyone else who wants to call. We're speaking to Mark Leland, author of, wait a minute, I want to get the title correct.
That's the
Happiness. John Leland. Happiness is a Choice You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old, and Dr. Mark Gronin's book, The End of Old Age. And if you're listening, give us a call, 877-NYU-DOCS. That's 877-698-3627. We do have a couple of emails I'm going to read. One is from Erica, who writes, I'm writing to share the story of my grandmother. She was one of the happiest, active, loving persons that I ever knew, even though she had gone through some terrible things in life. I asked her one day how she was so happy after so much trauma and illness, and she said, the alternative is boring. She died of cancer at age 94, and I'll never forget this lesson. Well, I think that speaks for itself, but John, any comments?
How can I add to that?
Yeah, fantastic.
Give the woman her due.
Mark?
I agree with that. That's really, you know, all of us hopefully are fortunate to have, you know, several elders in our lives who have profound impacts on us. And we look at it, it's usually not because of some complicated or amazing thing. It's something very simple but profound, a recipe, something they made for us, a story they told us. You know, again, these are the gifts of aging that, we all gain, and we have the ability to have a legacy in the form of these wonderful impacts on younger generations.
You know, I since I wrote this book, I've been going out and talking about it lately, and I love this because I meet such interesting people. And every time I do, there's somebody, there's people in the audience that know someone just like that, or else they are that person. And you hear that story, and you think, like, wait, that's really rare, except there's somebody else that has the same story, and then there's somebody else that has the same story. Yeah. You know, we all know somebody like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so maybe we should encourage our listeners to go talk to an older person and learn something from them.
That's true. It's healthy to do that.
You're lucky if you can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, here's another email from Christina, who writes, "My mother-in-law is awesome. She's 78 and plays tennis, is extremely active, lifts weights, and loves all sorts of activities. She's fiercely independent and proud of it. I am so happy that she's happy, but whenever I want to have a conversation about her care in the future, she totally shuts me down. It's like she doesn't accept the fact that one day she might be dependent on someone or need help. Is this okay? Should I worry?" Hmm.
Yeah,
okay, fortunately we have a psychiatrist on the phone.
I would say don't rain on the parade there. You know, if she doesn't, if she's dealing with this in her own way, and that you have to just let her do that. I mean, there may or may not come a day when that's the case. You never know, but you can't force those issues or conversations. But what I would say is focus on that script you have of her. It's a wonderful description, and I would challenge anyone listening, everyone listening, whatever situation you have, write a script of that person that celebrates who they are, what they've done, what's meaningful for them, because you can do that for every single person, even situations that seem quite tragic. It will help your perspective on it. It will help your relationship with them.
One of the people in my book is Jonas Mekas, who turned 95 on Christmas Eve. And he said to me, he said, "I never worry. Why worry about something when it's not happening? And then why worry when it happens? You deal with it. You waste all your time worrying," and he's Lithuanian, so he says, "and it may never happen what you think." And he goes, "Nothing is hopeless. I don't even know what it means, hopeless." And I don't think I go a week without quoting that either to somebody else or myself, because I usually need those words.
That's amazing. Yeah, because worry leads to anxiety.
And we've all, you know, we watch the news every night, and it's wherever you stand in the political spectrum, it's pretty ugly stuff on the news. And most of it's about stuff that might happen or might not happen.
Yeah, we're also getting it too fast, and it needs to be baked more before they throw it out there. But I'll tell you two guys this little story after we take this caller. If we have a moment, we'll speak first to Nancy, who's calling from here in New York. Hey, Nancy.
Hi.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I listen to this program all the time.
Oh, good. Thank you for listening.
I just wanted to give you a cute story that my dad died 2 years ago, 6 weeks shy of his 100th birthday. And in the last year and a half of his life, he had had a stroke, but he still functioned. And my daughter sat down with him. He was an avid reader, read the Times all the time, always loved to read and tell stories. And my daughter sat down next to him and she said, "Poppy, what can I read to you?" And he said, "War and Peace." So it just showed that he either wanted to hear the entire story again, and he had a purpose. He wanted to keep going.
That's amazing.
And we even used that story at his funeral because he just loved life.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I just thought I'd share that with you.
That's a great story, Nancy. And yeah, I think, John, you brought up how, you know, if you just sit and talk to folks, you'll find out a lot about them.
Yeah.
And I think that, and you might be interested in some of that. And it might be important for your own life. Right, I think that's
and some will be, and some will be boring, and some will be repetitive because people are people, and some will be hilarious and
so I want to we only got about a minute and a half remaining, but John, I wanted to ask you, you know, because you are a reporter, so you talk to some people who've been around or who are articulate. Did you get any history lessons, or did you ask any history questions about their stuff that was going on in the past? Because I tend to do that with patients all the time.
You know what? I really wanted to know what their lives were like today.
I saw. So you were focused on the present.
And so I did get stories from people's past, and it was funny. But, like, one of the guys had been in Nazi forced labor camps. We could have spent all our time talking about that. But I wouldn't, you know, we hear those stories. We can find out what the 30s were like.
Yeah.
What it was like to be gay in New York in 1950. Kind of interesting. But what it's like to be 92, hardly anybody knows that. And these people do.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. Interesting. Great perspective. And really a great book. So thank you so much, John Leland. Happiness is a Choice You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old, a great read. And also here, Dr. Mark Agronin and his book, The End of Old Age, Living a Longer, More Purposeful Life. I think, Mark, I love that. Wisdom, Purpose, and Creativity.
Thank you so much. Summary statement.
And this has been Dr. Michael Perskin for Dr. Radio Reports here on Dr. Radio at NYU Langone Medical Center, and we'll chat again sometime.